supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, as most of us know, in the last 10 days, Penn State's been in the throes of a developing, still developing, child abuse scandal that led to the firing of football icon beloved coach Joe Paterno. Of course, most of us are shocked and deeply troubled by allegations that Jerry Sandusky, a former Penn State defensive coordinator, sexually assaulted boys while conducting business through his charity for at-risk youth. Equally disturbing is the understanding that university stakeholders knew about the assaults and did nothing. No one called the police. No one came to the rescue of the children. Sound familiar? What other institutions have turned a blind eye on sexual assault? Catholic Church? Military? What other institutions? Well, on today's show, why do we look away? Why we cover up or protect? Does it all boil down to a form of cultural denial? We'll pose these questions with my guest, Jennifer Fried, who joins us from a studio at the University of Oregon. Jennifer's a professor of psychology there, and she has a new book in the works that she's co-authoring. It's called Betrayal. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Later on in the show, we're going to hear from two experts on pedophilia and sex abuse prevention, and we'll take your calls. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Jennifer, you recently told the BBC that people could suffer harm from confronting abuse, whether it's physical, sexual, professional, or psychological. They're all literally unable to recognize that abuse exists in the first place.
Yes, that's correct.
How does that happen? What's the mechanism?
My colleagues and I and my students and I have been developing a theory of betrayal trauma. And we have noticed that often a response to betrayal, when it's perpetrated by someone close to us, whether that's a person in our life or an institution, that the response is what we call betrayal blindness. That includes being unaware, not knowing, even forgetting that the betrayal occurred.
So not seeing what you're really seeing.
Yes. And we believe that this stems from a desire to preserve and protect necessary relationships. So if you get betrayed by somebody you're not dependent upon, you're going to feel the sting of being betrayed and take action. And the actions that you would take are kind of like fight and flight. You will confront or withdraw from that person or institution that betrayed you. However, if you're highly dependent on that person, say it's your parent or your employer, you may have a need to not see the betrayal because those very actions that you would otherwise take may only make your situation worse by pushing away the person or the institution you very much need.
So it actually could do harm.
That's right. It's a survival mechanism for somebody caught in that dependency situation. And although eventually that very survival mechanism creates trouble, it can keep people alive and keep people employed and keep people taken care of.
You also said in the article that opening one's mind to the realities of sexual abuse can be intimidating. What do you mean?
Well, once you become aware of a wrongdoing, it's very difficult not to take action. We are probably, through our evolutionary history, are designed to detect betrayal, unfairness, and cheating, and do something about it. It's difficult, if you fully see it, to just sit there and do nothing. And so once you do see it, you know, you're probably going to do something. And if you do something, you rock the boat and quite likely risk your own comfort, your own situation. For instance, you might lose your job if you confront betrayal.
That one would argue, well, let's make that concrete here. So it's widely reported that an assistant coach at Penn State, I think he was a graduate student at the time, saw a 10-year-old boy being sodomized in the shower by Sandusky. He saw it. He didn't intervene. He walked away, and he told his father. Now, what's the mechanism that enabled him to walk away?
Well, of course, I don't know exactly what went on through in his mind. I don't know what he believed he was even supposed to do. One of the things that is a problem in how these crimes do or don't get reported is people often don't know exactly what they're supposed to do. But I can tell you from research that we've done on both individuals who've been abused by people themselves and individuals in the context where abuse has been occurring, that they often respond to these sorts of events with some degree of unawareness, even not being able to remember the event occurred. So it's possible that a person who would walk in on child sexual abuse occurring does not fully comprehend what he's seen, that there are mental mechanisms that can keep information out of one's immediate consciousness. I don't know in this case if those were sure operating, but it's certainly possible.
I've got a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, who said he conjectures that, well, this guy just wanted to keep his job. That's all. That was his priority. Is it that simple? Could it be that simple?
Well, at one level, yes. But that doesn't mean that those were thoughts that went through his head or somebody's head in that situation. This can operate outside of conscious awareness. If you think about the situation, the simple situation, and unfortunately one that occurs to many people, of being directly a victim of abuse. So let's step away from this case for a minute and imagine a situation where you have a child who's being abused by a parent. That child is dependent upon the parent for everything. And if the child is aware of the abuse, the child may respond in a way that will push the parent away. So being less attached to the parent, less lovable, confronting the parent, withdrawing from the parent. Those are responses that endanger the child. And thus, our theory and research suggests the child's able, in many instances, to not fully be aware of, comprehend, or remember the abuse, and in so doing, stay attached. Now, we've recently been looking at whether these same mechanisms may occur when we see people in the context of institutions, and we've been developing a concept of institutional betrayal. And we have just begun the empirical work on institutional betrayal, but we do believe that individuals can have a similar kind of unconscious, you might say, reaction where the betrayal is around them, but they so need the institution that they don't fully grasp it.
So it's beyond simple heartlessness.
Exactly.
Yeah. I can relate, Jennifer. We did a I'm sorry. We did a similar show last year, and I had addressed my sexual abuse by my seventh grade teacher, and I was dependent on him. I wasn't consciously aware of my dependency, and actually until I read some of your background research and literature. But this is a guy who introduced me to psychology, and he was the guy that convinced me that I had the brains and the heart to be a psychologist. So he was the first guy that believed in me, so I had to maintain that relationship. And I have to tell you, it was 15 years, maybe more, before I realized that what happened that day was sexual abuse.
Wow. Well, one of the things that your comments remind me to mention is that among people out there responding to situations like this, of course, are many people who themselves have been victimized in exactly this way. And while it sounds like you've become aware of the significance of that, many people haven't. And for those people who were themselves victims, when they confront, when they see this going on in their institution, or I shouldn't say see it, when it's happening in their institution, they may not be able to see it because they, in seeing it happen to somebody else, they'd have to confront it in themselves, and they may have a need still not to see it. So we're not just talking about a world of bystanders who are entirely removed from this topic. We're talking about a world of bystanders that includes very high levels of victimization and even some people who are themselves perpetrators.
So
when you think about people's motivations for not seeing, it gets pretty complicated.
Well, and one of the things we know is that the whole issue of perpetrator is not black or white. You know, we're going to be talking with a couple of experts on pedophilia later on in the show, and we're going to hear that, you know, there's a continuum of perpetrators, and you know, one of the questions I'm going to raise is how many people have sexual fantasies about younger girls? So, you know, it's all pretty gray out there. You know, it's not at all black and white. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about something called betrayal blindness with Jennifer Fried. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We do have to say, Jennifer, right up front, that the vast majority of sexual abuse cases takes place in the family.
That's right.
And there's a kind of institutional denial there also.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that I think is promising about what's happening right now in terms of discussing the Penn State situation is that people are, in fact, outraged about the lack of reporting and that it happened, the sexual abuse happened at all. And I think this is a good sign for our society, because this has been going on for a very long time, and it goes on in at high frequencies, both, of course, sometimes in institutional settings and even, as you just pointed out, at even higher rates inside families. And so having people talk about it is probably the number one way to counter this blindness.
You've also talked about this blindness, betrayal blindness, is going way beyond child sexual abuse. You've brought up issues like adultery, inequities in society and in the workplace.
Yes.
How does that look? How does that manifest itself?
Well, recently we've been trying to develop measures to actually study betrayal blindness and institutional betrayal quantitatively, but we've also conducted case studies and looked at historical events for indication that this phenomenon occurs at different levels. And we see institutional betrayal as wrongdoings perpetrated by an institution upon individuals that are dependent on that institution. And this includes the failure to prevent or respond supportively to wrongdoings by individuals. So for instance, an institution failing to prevent or respond appropriately to sexual assault is a kind of institutional betrayal, but so is direct wrongdoings such as exploiting employees or locking people up in concentration camps. There's both kinds of institutional betrayal. Recently, we've been investigating institutional betrayal in the context of college campuses, where institutions may fail to prevent sexual assault or fail to respond appropriately when it's brought to their attention. It's interesting in light of the Penn State situation, but we've found a alarmingly high rate of institutional betrayal, and precisely this particular issue of failing to prevent and respond appropriately to sexual assault.
You know, as I listen to you talk about institutional denial or denial of a culture, the Holocaust and World War II wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't have imagined any Holocausts would have happened without institutional denial.
Yes, it's quite pervasive and very much a part of our history. We see it at the certainly in the Catholic Church cover up in the Holocaust in the French Roundup that's recently been brought to people's attention through the popular book and movie Sarah's Key. It's really everywhere if we look at major historical events in which people were harmed.
I would assume, getting back to who gets abused, I would imagine that when sexual abuse happens in the middle of this context of institutional denial, I would imagine the effects are much worse.
Well, we have some indication that that's true. In a study, Carly Smith, who is one of my doctoral students and I recently conducted, we measured the people's experiences with sexual assault, their experiences with institutional betrayal, and also their difficulties afterwards. And we found that, of course, sexual assault is associated with all sorts of difficulties afterwards. Not everybody shows these difficulties, but there's much higher probability that people will have problems with depression, dissociation, anxiety, post-traumatic stress. And what we found was that for those victims of sexual assault who also found institutional betrayal or were confronted with institutional betrayal, that they had even greater levels of these problems. So the institutional betrayal exacerbates the effects of sexual assault.
I want to come back, before we take our break, I want to come back to the institution itself. How do we work with the mind of an institution?
Well, of course, institutions don't exactly have minds, but they're populated
with people. Many
of them
absolutely don't.
Yeah, they're populated with people. And, you know, many people want to do the right thing. And so when they're given the opportunity to become aware and to understand, they often will make right. As I said before, I'm very hopeful that we can see a shift in our society, that the more we talk about these matters and take appropriate steps, we will reduce both institutional betrayal, but then also the actual underlying betrayal traumas, such as sexual assault.
I love listening to a hopeful researcher. It just warms the cockles of my heart. Jennifer, stick with us. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk a little more after our break. Jennifer Fried studies institutional denial and betrayal blindness, and we will talk with her in just a minute. We'll also take your calls. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Astrophysicist Saul Perlmutter was part of the team awarded the 2011 Nobel Prize for the discovery that the expansion of the universe wasn't slowing down, but accelerating.
What we were seeing was a little bit like throwing the apple up in the air and it blasting off into space.
Saul Perlmutter explains it on the next Fresh Air. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. The Penn State scandal's been covered by lots of people in lots of different directions, but today we're talking about denial. What happens in a mind, in an institution, that can see and not see at the same time? My guest for this segment is Jennifer Fried. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, studied institutional betrayal for more than 20 years. She's just finishing a new book that she's co-written called betrayal. Later on, we're going to hear from Michael Stinson and Ken Singer, experts respectively on treatment and prevention for both victims and perpetrators. Jennifer, pedophilia has been around forever. Ancient Greeks recognized intimate relationships between adult males and young boys and said that was just part of their education.
Yes.
So we've been comfortable with it. So as long as that's been around forever, what about denial? Has that been around forever also?
Well, in one form or another, yes. Certainly there have been times when people have acknowledged that there's been sexual activity between adults and children and even considered that acceptable. But there's been denial about the harm that these activities cause to the less powerful person in the relationship. And in our current world, there's a huge amount of denial still about the actual behavior itself.
And denial about the incidence and prevalence of it.
Yes,
also.
Yes.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Kelly Moore on the line. She's a writer who lives in the D.C. area. She's published a couple of articles for the Huffington Post about the Penn State child sexual abuse scandal. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I read one of your articles when you came out kind of guns a-blazing, and you called the men who did not follow through to help the children in this case cowards.
Yes, I mean, I don't really know what other word you could use to describe this. I mean, you're talking about, for the most part, in this very sad story, you're talking about individuals, men who are actually really quite powerful and had a lot of influence, potentially, over the situation. And they chose not to exercise any of that influence, based at least on what we know so far. And, I know of no other way to describe that other than cowardly.
Jennifer, could you offer another way to describe it? Or I would imagine you wouldn't 100% agree with Kelly.
Well, I think that it's the case that there's both a reality to the cowardliness and also a way we can maybe understand sometimes this behavior that's a little bit different. I want to make clear that I think people are responsible. They must be held responsible and accountable. And it's, in no way do I mean to be giving people excuses to not do what's right. From a perspective of a research psychologist, we're trying to understand how behavior comes about and ultimately what we can do to change conditions so we see less of the problematic behavior. I don't know for these particular individuals their level of awareness. It's possible in some cases they were aware and they made a conscious decision not to do anything about it. It's also possible that some of these individuals were not fully aware of what was going on and what they were supposed to do about it for the reasons we are talking about, betrayal blindness.
But I think that once you hear there's a naked man and a naked boy and they're in a shower, I mean, I'm not sure that you really need much more information to know that there's something here that needs looking into. And I think what has to be borne in mind in this case is that there was an initial incident in 1998, which was investigated by the campus police. There are some questions about how thorough that investigation was. The prosecutor chose not to prosecute. So then when this happens again in 2002, I think for many people, that changes the dynamic. That changes the consideration, because this is now, at least it appears to be, a repeat episode.
Let me pull one thread out of there, and I'm going to ask you to respond, Jennifer. One of the issues that I'm hearing is that, I've been listening to you from the perspective of a psychologist. And what I hear Kelly doing is listening through the ears of a regular person, not one of us. And so what you're saying makes sense theoretically, but it's really difficult to wrap your mind around something like that. I mean, here we see this heinous crime going on. And that's not cowardice. You know, it's difficult to understand.
Yeah, and I think that there's some danger that I, in trying to apply these issues on cases where I don't know what was going on inside the individual's mind. And I don't reject the word cowardice as a possible explanation here. In fact, at a societal level, we are all cowards to the extent that we turn a blind eye to this matter. Almost everybody has at one point or another failed to act on seeing a wrongdoing. And one of the things that the challenges for all of us in our society is to speak up, speak out, and be accountable, both as scientists and as bystanders. So I totally agree that it's horrendous when people see these things and don't do anything about it. What we're trying to understand from the perspective of psychological research is how it could be that sometimes people who might be good people nonetheless fail to do the right thing in situations like this. And it's in that context, in part, that we're developing this theory of betrayal blindness and finding evidence that victims often fail to see what's going on. And if victims can fail to see what's going on and fail to be aware, so can bystanders.
Yeah, that's just what I described before our break. Jennifer, let's go to the phones. We got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Lisa, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. As a victim of childhood abuse, I feel so strongly that adults have to take a stand to protect all children. And I recently had a situation presented to me that showed clear abuse and neglect of a child. And out of this group of people, not one person was willing to go forward. And as a mandatory reporter, as a healthcare provider, I said, fine, I'll do it. And I want people to know that they really can report to Child Protective Services anonymously. And that people can really make a difference to the child.
Thank you. That is very true.
Yeah, it is very true. And you know, I've had that experience myself. And, you know, we can help save children's lives. Let's get another call on. We've got Sandy on the line. Sandy?
Dr. Dan?
Yes.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that this is a great show because of all of the, it's out there in the media and everybody thinks that child abuse is not accepted anymore. But the problem is, and I see this in this case, it's about shooting the messenger. No matter if it's a family institution or a large institution, there is a power hierarchy. If it's a grandfather or an uncle, you are sometimes, as the messenger, ostracized or shunned from the family. So, or as you say, in the case of an institution, losing your job. So what happens is the cover up begins because of the denial that goes on. We have to, as a society, stop denying that sexual abuse is as prevalent as it is. I think that we have just a long way to go with that. And I'm not excusing the man that observed that. He was a man. He was 28 years old. However, I do see it still going on. I think it is deplorable, but it must be, we must admit that it is still going on and something we have to address it. Until people are afraid to come up and report it, we will always have this problem. Thank you.
Yeah,
you're
very welcome. Jennifer, I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I think the point that people who do dare to speak out often in some way get punished is a good point. And one of the things that we can all do is support people when they do speak up, whether they are talking about their own victimization or what they've observed.
Yeah, and it's not just sexual abuse. You know, we often blame the victim. We did it when AIDS first came out. We do it with people who are living on the street and hungry. That's our tendency to keep ourselves safe, is we blame the victim, keep our own institutions, our personal institutions safe.
Exactly.
Jennifer, unfortunately, we're out of time. I have to say goodbye to you, and we're going to take a break and come back and speak with Michael Stinson and Ken Singer.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was wonderful, and your work is fascinating, and please keep it up. It's
Thank
so
you.
Important. Jennifer Fried is a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon. She's finishing up her new book that she's co-written, and it's called Betrayal. When we come back, we're going to speak with Michael Stinson and Ken Singer. Michael's director of prevention services here in Philadelphia at the Joseph J. Peters Institute. Ken Singer is a social worker in Lambertville who treats both perpetrators and victims of childhood sexual abuse. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to the Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Hands from the Heart Home Healthcare Services, providing non-medical in-home assistance to seniors, expectant and new mothers, and those recovering from an injury or illness. 855-6-HOME-NOW or handsfromtheharthomehealthcare.com.
There was no waterboarding, no violence, only hours and hours of questioning. Then Adrian Thomas confessed to causing his infant son's death, but did he really do it?
When you've been bombarded hours with questions, you know it's not the truth.
Tough questions about interrogations in the new documentary, Scenes of a Crime. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Elizabeth Bennett and Associates, providing personalized and discreet divorce and family law services through litigation, mediation, collaboration, and negotiation. Located in Wayne, PA. Online at ebennettlaw.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host.
The actions that we are witnessing now from the riots last night only reinforces to victims everywhere that it's not safe to tell what happened, to get help, and to bravely tell your story to stop the offender from hurting you. This is why victims don't come forward, and we're outraged.
That was Delilah Romberg. She's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. She was speaking last week in reaction to student riots in State College. Let's get to two people now who know quite a bit about what communities and families go through to address child sexual abuse and prevent it. Michael Stinson is Director of Prevention Services at the Joseph J. Peters Institute here in Philadelphia. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we are also joined by Ken Singer. He's a social worker in Lambertville, and he's written Evicting the Perpetrator, a Male Survivor's Guide to Recovery from Childhood Sexual Abuse. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Ken, let's start with you. While you were listening to the clip that we just played by Delilah Romberg, what was going through your mind?
Well, I'm thinking that this is a problem that has existed, you know, as you pointed out, time immemorial. And, the role of bystanders in terms of this Penn State case is just so significant. And people need to be encouraged to be able to speak up and take some action, even though the victim may not be in a position to do that. But any bystander could or should have done that.
Well, you know, one of the problems I have, and you know, we'll bring Michael into the discussion also. One of the problems I have is that everybody's outraged. And sure, what happened was outrageous, but we're pointing fingers all over the place. We're calling people names. And I mean, it seems to me that we need to create an environment where people feel safe to to come out and report their own sexual abuse or someone else's. And with the intensity of this anger, I mean, it's anything but safe. Michael, do you have any?
Well, I agree with you completely. When you look at the situation and every day there's new allegations that come out, you know, people need to step back, take a breath for a minute to loosen up on the anxiety, because that kind of drives that kind of finger-pointing, that reality. When you look at the fuller picture, you know, we absolutely believe that adults are responsible to prevent child sexual abuse. When you wait for a child to come forward, you've waited too long. That's quite clearly the case. So how do we do that? How do you build the capacity in people to actually make that next step, ask that next question, go that next extra mile to find out whether or not we're really talking about the issue of sexual abuse or abuse, or whether it's some other reality that maybe we don't have to take into consideration at that particular moment? It's not as glaring.
Michael, when we spoke with Jennifer Fried, we were talking about institutions and denial. Some institutions are safer and some are not. So what can be done to help institutions change, to open up, to soften up, to make it safer for these things to be reported?
One of the problems that you run into with institutions is the power structure, oftentimes how they're created in the first place. So who has access to it? How does that transfer generationally, because institutions run over a long period of time? How does that power structure then transfer down the line? Who has access to it? You know, when we're talking about people that have power positions, titles, oftentimes we never question their behavior, and we need to take a different look at it.
So what kind of institution will be more open, and what will be more, put people more at risk?
Well, obviously institutions that are very rigid, that have a very limited access structure, that have very difficult requirements for people to get into that power structure, that power dynamic. Those are institutions that oftentimes are the most problematic.
We, you know, when we spoke with you earlier, you had spoken about protocols that institutions need to have, and of course they do, and it could have prevented a lot of problems. But is it about protocol, or is it about an institutional mentality or heart?
It's a combination, I think, of both of them. I mean, if we're talking about a protocol, protocols are only as good as the people who are going to implement them. When we're looking at these kinds of situations, you know, it's very difficult oftentimes to actually pinpoint exactly where it went wrong. Maybe this is not such a case where you can't pinpoint, but, you know, and a lot of times those institutions, those protocols, it's very difficult to look at, you know, one instance and say that's the one that really was, it all went downhill from there.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Beth on the line. Hi, Beth.
Yeah, my question is about the people. How do you take care of the people who do the reporting? I'm not talking about the victims or the offenders. I'm talking about the people who lose this relationship with these institutions or even their family members when they are supportive of the victim, they do the reporting, and as a result they lose. I'm in a situation where I've lost a relationship with my entire family, because I am the lone person saying something needs to happen with the one who's doing the offending, who's been in jail, who's been adjudicated and served time for offending. And as a result, since I'm the one saying this person is an offender, we need to be careful around them and get them help as well as the victim, I've lost a relationship with my whole family because they are in denial that the event even happened. How do you bring that situation to some kind? How do you get people to report when this is what they're risking, and how do you deal with the loss that people feel with their relationships
well,
with institutions and families?
Yeah,
I can respond to that, Dan.
Yeah, Ken.
I find with a lot of male survivors, and I guess this applies equally to female survivors as well, but the loss of the family and the supports that happen within family disruptions is pretty common. And a lot of people have developed their own networks and own communities of people that respond to them in a positive way. So when you've got somebody who feels totally abandoned, an organization like Male Survivor, which has a discussion board and chat rooms and things like that, people create their own communities.
And that's what needs to happen. Beth, you know, with your situation, you know, there's a painful price you're paying by doing the right thing. And I'll tell you what makes your situation worse is when you try to get people to do something they can't or won't do. And that's going to make your situation even more painful. There's a steep price you've paid for doing the right thing, and there's going to be a lot of fallout inside yourself, including, you know, grief and a kind of loneliness. So I'm sorry for your loss, but I have a feeling you have no regret for doing what you've done. Ken, I want to come back to you. When I did some research, I found that people who commit these sexual offenses, other than sexual offenses, are usually law-abiding. So tell us about what kind of people they are and what goes on inside of them. Do they know they're ill? Do they feel remorse or guilt?
Well, most perpetrators have to go through what's called cognitive distortions, distorted thinking or thinking errors. And it's just like the same kind of reasoning or rationale that people use. They're going over the speed limit. They recognize they're going over the speed limit. They could get a ticket, get into an accident, get points, and all this other stuff. And they know reasonably well that they shouldn't be doing this, but they make it okay to do that. Perpetrators also create the rationalizations and the justifications, and many of them don't really see that they're harming the child, but different gradations of, well, the minimizing, you know, that this is not so bad and the kid is going to have an erection and he's going to enjoy himself and that sort of thing. So it's kind of an insidious process, just fooling yourself.
Do they have anything in common? You've been in the field for a long time. Do they have anything in common beyond this offense, similar history, similar personalities, anything?
They're all over the place. Somebody said they're just like us, and you know, the description of perpetrators, you want to find something that's going to be creepy or sleazy or some way distinguishable from normal people, but they're just like us.
So I've got a turn now here to Michael Stinson from Joseph J. Peters. Part of the problem with being here in the studio with me is I get to see your expressions, and now I've got to ask you, when Ken said they're just like us, you had a visible reaction.
Right, and that hit it right on the head. When people think about sex offenders, sex abusers, it's always about the guy with the one tooth and the scraggly hair on the front of the paper. He looks like a sex offender, or what we want them to look like. This is very different, and this kind of brings it all home. He looks just like anybody. I mean, in the store, you know, walking down the aisle, walking down the sidewalk, it could be anybody. We did a random digital survey in Philadelphia in 2006. And, you know, people, when they were asked to describe, you know, what sex offending was, what sexual abuse was, what they thought of as an offender, it was all over the place.
Wait a minute here. That I understand. But are you walking us down the path of stranger danger, that we should be worried about everybody?
Well, stranger danger, I wouldn't go that far. Stranger danger is still important, but, you know, it's only about 10% of the cases. You know, about 80 to 90% of the time, the child already knows the offender. So it's somebody that's usually close to that child and has access to that child. So stranger danger is still important, but it's not as important as making sure that children have the vocabulary to talk, the opportunity to talk, the power, the opportunity within the family structure to tell their story in an authentic way.
How do we do that?
Well, you know, the way that you talk to kids is really important. When you're talking to kids, don't badger them. Give them an opportunity. We want people to be able to talk about sex and sexual behavior. because it gives children that opportunity and gives them the words that helps them find the words to describe exactly the way they feel.
Ken, how do you talk to a child about sex, a young child? Because that's what we need to know. An awful lot of kids are abused before they hit puberty.
Yeah, there are programs that go into the schools like CAP, Child Assault Prevention, which teaches kids at an age-appropriate level that they have a right to be assertive, they have a right to their bodies, no one has the right to touch them, and so forth. And it really helps kids understand, become more assertive. Most of the offenders that I've worked with over the years, I'm 30 years plus in this business, the offender was told that by the kid in an assertive way to stop, most of them would do it. Now, it doesn't guarantee every situation is going to result in stop. They have the right to be assertive.
Do you want to react to that or add to it, Michael?
Oh, I agree with that completely. But, you know, we're also talking about the family structure itself. When we talk about family structures, a lot of times what we look at as denial is because, you know, there aren't very many resources to help people work through this situation. You can commit yourself all the way and call the police or in Philadelphia DHS or do nothing at all. What is the middle ground? How can we take people from A to B to C to D to work through this situation? And that's really tough.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Christina on the line. Christina, hi. You're on Voices.
I know you don't have a lot of time. I just wanted to say that I had been sexually abused as a child, and it really messed with my trust issues. And you know, as I was growing up, and I have as a mother of two boys now, I am so hypervigilant, and you know, everywhere I see problems, and this whole Penn State thing really, really has horrified and freaked me out.
No, I'm sure it has. How old are your boys?
10 and 13.
And I'm going to ask you a question. I want my experts to weigh in on it. Do they know about your history?
No.
How old were you when you were abused, may I ask?
I don't know when it might have begun, but I was about 8 when it stopped because I started running from the abuser.
Okay. So I want to hear from my experts about their thoughts about sharing your story. We'll start with you, Michael.
You know, sharing the story with your kids, I'm not exactly sure that at this particular age that's the reality for them. I mean, it is the reality for you, and I'm sorry that happened to you. But it's really important when we're talking about talking to kids, giving them an opportunity, is to oftentimes provide, you know, teachable moments that end up being learnable moments. When we have a situation like this, you can sit down at the dinner table and say, you know what, that Penn State thing is really horrible, isn't it? And then get some feedback from your kids, what they think about it, what they think about the situation. When we're talking about oftentimes children that were bullied that end up killing themselves, that's an opportunity to bring that up. Find out how your kids feel about it, what they would do in the similar situation, what could have been done maybe to stop it from happening in the first place. Those are really important aspects. You need to ask your kids those kinds of questions to find out where they feel the most comfortable, whether they're going in the right direction, whether you need to reframe the issue and the power structure a little bit different for them.
Yeah, and I would strongly encourage you to do that, Christine, and don't just act out of your own anxiety, because what they'll do is they'll pick up your anxiety and be reactive to your anxiety and just have no vehicle to understand it, to talk about it. And if you do have that conversation, it might make everybody feel better. So I encourage you to do it, and I appreciate your calling in. Michael, there was a study in 2008, the National Criminal Justice Reference Center. They found that Megan's Law was not working and not worth the expense. What are your thoughts?
Megan's Law is difficult. It was put in place, the registry was put in place for the concept of public safety, that people could go online, check out who was in their community, where they were, you know, what their crime happened to be. But it wasn't really all that detailed. When you look at that registry, you know, we're only looking at people that we already know about. We're not looking at the people that maybe are out there abusing, that live right next door, or maybe look at you from across the dinner table. You know, those people aren't on the registry. Those are the people that we really need to add an additional level of scrutiny to.
I would add that treatment works, and you're putting the need for prevention services on the back burner if you're only doing treatment and locking up people and putting them on registries. They've got to have an aspect of prevention. Stop It Now is a good organization for primary prevention, especially with their emphasis on bystander involvement that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, we all have a great deal to learn, and we all have a great deal to do. And both of you guys are doing wonderful work and important work, and please, please continue to teach us what needs to be done. My guests have been Michael Stinson and Ken Singer. Michael's Director of Prevention Services at Joseph J. Peters Institute here in Philly. Ken has a social worker at Lambertville. He's written Evicting the Perpetrator, a Male Survival Guide to Recovery from Childhood Sexual Abuse. Hey, listen, this Wednesday I'm going to be giving a talk at Newman University. It'll be at 10 a.m. It's called The Wounding and the Healing of the Student Athlete, where we address issues like isolation, ostracism, and that critical judge inside. Look on my webpage for more detail. Next week, we're going to talk about who's coming to dinner over the holidays, how families mark the passing of time with pronouncements, births, feuds, and feasts. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Our intern is Emily Haas. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.